This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, I'm Linda Mottram. In this episode, what can we learn from the former Deputy Prime Minister Tim Fischer, who's died of leukaemia? The energy regulator assesses the risk your power will be cut in the coming summer, and a fire is ravaging the Earth's lungs, the Amazon rainforest. Soldier and farmer, politician and author, ambassador and irrepressible train spotter. Tim Fischer is being remembered as one of Australia's most unique and best-loved politicians today. The former Deputy Prime Minister has died of leukaemia at 73. Born in the New South Wales Riverina, the boy from Borey Creek was passionate about country Australia. But during his long political career with the National Party and his subsequent public life, he managed to charm people both in the bush and the city. Former National Party leader John Anderson joins me in a moment, but first, Samantha Donovan reports on Tim Fischer's life and today's tributes.
The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, says Tim Fischer's finest moment was his campaign to change Australia's gun laws in the wake of the 96 Port Arthur massacre. He toured the country trying to convince hostile Nationals voters change was needed.
It is about taking out of the suburbs of Australia the semi-automatics and automatics that should not be in the suburbs of Australia in the first place. Hippie can walk tall and the fringe elements can go to Mars.
It was an issue he remained passionate about to the end. Mr. Fischer spoke to PM after the Christchurch massacre in March and warned New Zealand to resist pressure from America's NRA.
I want to make the point the National Rifle Association of the USA has a global beat, and they intervened and made representations at the time of the John Howard law reform. They will do so again in New Zealand, I predict, and put a viewpoint, and they are to be resisted at every stage.
After serving as a New South Wales state MP, Tim Fischer was elected to the federal seat of Farrer in 1984. In something of a surprise victory, he was elected the federal Nationals leader in 1990.
As federal leader, I will be carving out an image for the Parliamentary National Party, which in some reform can be taking the party back to the provincial bush.
He led the party for 9 years and was the deputy PM from 96 to 99. The Nationals leader, Michael McCormack, has today remembered Tim Fischer as a mighty human being.
And the nation mourns one of its finest. Tim Fischer, AC. The AC, in my opinion, stands for a champion, a colossus. I love Tim Fischer. I always will. He was a mentor. He was a friend. Tim Fischer loved country people. Country people loved Tim. He loved Australia, and Australians loved Tim. They rallied behind him. They knew that in Tim Fischer they had someone who deeply cared about their interests, which were his interests.
Tim Fischer was conscripted for service in Vietnam and was injured in the 1968 Battle of Firebase Coral.
A patient at the Australian Field Hospital at Wong Tower is Second Lieutenant Tim Fischer. He comes from Borey Creek via Wagga.
Hello, folks. Surprise. I have this opportunity to wish you a happy Christmas.
Last year, he told Australian Story his Vietnam service contributed to his health problems.
I thank Uncle Sam in Vietnam for 4 cancers, prostate cancer, bladder cancer, and then a couple of melanomas. I had operations in 1st Battalion Royal Australian Regiment. Agent Orange was widely used. At least one specialist has suggested my immunity broke down a lot more quickly as a direct consequence.
Mr. Fischer was born in the New South Wales Riverina town of Lockhart. He grew up on the family farm, the Peppers, at nearby Borey Creek. The Lockhart Mayor, Roger Shermer, has paid tribute to him as a unique Australian.
Tim was Tim when he arrived back in Lockhart on visits. He would talk to everybody. Everybody said hello. He would doff the hat as he normally did and usually, you know, sing out greetings at the top of his voice. He mixed very easily with people, regardless of whether it was in his hometown or whether it was in Canberra or, in fact, the Vatican. He He just had that personality.
As Trade Minister in the Howard government, Tim Fischer visited 60 or so nations in just a few years and garnered the nickname Two-Minute Tim because of the frenetic pace he kept up both at home and abroad.
And I just suddenly thought, one day I'm going to arrive back in a box on a jumbo. It was grinding away and gnawing at me.
He decided to retire from Parliament in 2001.
I've had personal and particular cause to change my mind and bring forward a decision, which I now present to the House as a matter of courtesy.
Tim Fischer went on to other roles, including Chairman of Tourism Australia, the National Chairman of the Royal Flying Doctor Service, and Australia's first resident ambassador to the Holy See. Friends speak of his devotion to his wife Judy and sons Harrison and Dominic. The Prime Minister says he's offering Mr. Fischer's family a state funeral to celebrate his life and his extraordinary contribution to Australia.
Samantha Donovan with that report. Well, former Federal Nationals MP John Anderson served as Tim Fischer's deputy for 7 years and is himself a former leader of the party. He joins me. John Anderson, welcome. Thank you for speaking with us today. Tim was such a genuine bloke, wasn't he? Unique, do you think?
Yes, he was unique. I mean, everyone's unique, but he was, I suppose, a bit of a tautology, uniquely unique. He had a couple of qualities that I think were deeply admirable, and some people might say are old-fashioned, but I don't think if you stop and think about them, they are. He was brave, but he was more than that. Tim didn't give or take offence. In the tough game of politics, I don't think I ever heard him abuse somebody who'd abused him, even in private, even afterwards when you walked away and he was hurting. Tim was unbelievably gracious in the way that he treated others, and I think that lies in large part behind the outpouring of respect that we've heard for him.
I guess one of the times when he probably displayed that best was when he was out fighting to get support for John Howard's gun laws, because he took a lot of flack for that, didn't he?
Well, he did. He believed in them and always did, and has continued to all the way through. I think it was particularly tough in Queensland, because Queensland was doing it very tough at the time. There was a shocking drought. There was great uncertainty over a number of other issues at the time. And as sometimes happens in politics, people were probably not in the best of moods. Then this descended. But Tim was a courageous man, both personally and I think publicly. When you're close to someone, you get to see that over time. He was a very honest man. Didn't like talking about himself. And right to the very end, I spoke to him only a few days before it reached the point where he didn't want to communicate anymore. He didn't want to talk about himself. He brushed aside his problems and went straight to the things that interested him, his family, what was happening globally, what was happening here at home politically. But that courage that he displayed towards the end and that selflessness, they are the mark of Tim Fischer, who was quite an unusual and a unique man, and in many ways a very admirable man.
We played a little clip of Tim in that package that Sam Donovan just prepared for us, where he was talking to us earlier this month, just a few months ago, after the Christchurch massacre, about New Zealand and guns and so forth. I'd called him on that day, and he was on a train, and he was instantly cooperative and wonderful, even though he was going for treatment. And he said to me, "Ring me back in 20 minutes, because I know I'm going through this particular town, and the internet's very good there, and we'll have a great line, and we can do the interview then." I mean, every time I've spoken to Tim Fischer over the years, that's what he's been like. Incredibly generous and really smart, but there's always a train reference in there. Do you have a train or transport memory involving Tim Fischer?
Oh, yes, I do. I remember I had to go and talk at FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization, emergency meeting on global food security at the end of the 90s. And Tim was still leader, I was deputy. I had to leave then and go to Milan. So we're sitting in question time, and he wrote out on a piece of paper, he said, "Now, if you catch the 4:06 out of Rome, you'll arrive in Milan in time for your meeting, and then you can take such and such a flight." It was absolutely extraordinary. I think if Tim had ever wanted to be a millionaire, he'd have made a fantastic travel organiser, a travel agent. He was unbelievable.
What is the... You mentioned his incredible... You said bravery and his willingness to take the punches and not give that anger back. What is the lesson, do you think, as we think about Tim Fischer for today's politics?
I think it's not just for today's politics. It's how we deport ourselves. We have got to learn to disagree with one another in some degree of respect and harmony if we're to ever negotiate our way forward. That applies in the schoolyard, it applies in the sporting club, it applies to local government, it applies to the way we get on with our neighbours, it applies to the way we go forward as a nation. We've just got to remember again what Tim Fischer showed us so clearly, that was better understood in an age gone by, that a lot of things history can teach us are very valuable, and one of them is that when you allow your personal feelings to get in the way of relationships, you'll never negotiate your way forward.
Former National Party leader John Anderson, thank you for those reflections on Tim Fischer today.
Thank you.
Well, what is the risk that your home or the industry you work in will experience blackouts this summer? The Australian Energy Market Operator has released its annual assessment and says supply and demand will be tight in several states for the 2019-20 summer. It says it highlights the need for short and longer term investment in dispatchable resources and transmission. Audrey Zibelman is the head of the Energy Market Operator.
The fact is that we can't plan these outages. They happen. So we're saying we need the types of resources to withstand those types of events. We as a system operator don't want to be reactive. We're saying in the summer is not the time to get the reserves and the resources. Let's have them in the system because that's the cheapest way that we can meet the energy needs of consumers and the safest way as well.
But are today's headlines about millions of households being at risk of blackouts this summer correct? Investigative reporter Stephen Long from the ABC's business unit has been reading this new report and writing about it today. He joined me earlier. Stephen, what does the report say is the risk that energy supplies won't meet demand this summer?
I think essentially the report really says that the risk is low, despite all the hype we've had about it, Linda. So in every state other than Victoria, it says that the current reliability standard will be met over summer and for the next 10 years. And the current reliability standard says the risk of losing power must be less than 0.002% over a 10-year period. So that's pretty small. In Victoria, there's a slightly higher risk, but even there, the risk is very, very low, other than if we get a series of very unfortunate events where you got extremely hot weather and two coal-fired power stations that are currently offline don't come back online over the summer, and you couldn't get supply from other states. Then they say you could have hundreds of thousands of homes lose power or the equivalent thereof, and the devil's in the detail. Equivalent to doesn't mean you're going to have hundreds of thousands or millions lose power.
But we have seen one-off events, unforeseen circumstances that have pushed parts of the grid beyond its limits in recent years. And AEMO says it observes there's greater risks of load shedding during hot days. While the Federal Energy Minister, Angus Taylor, made this point about Victoria's power situation.
You cannot shut a power station as big and as important as Hazelwood, an attempt to completely replace it with solar cells on people's roofs. Now, there's nothing wrong with solar cells on people's roofs, but you have to have balance in the system. And the Victorian government's determination to get rid of its coal-fired power stations prematurely is having an impact on Victorians and will continue to.
So, Stephen, how do we pull all this together? Because it does feel like everyone is saying it is getting worse, even if millions of households losing power isn't likely.
Well, the first observation I'd make is that Victoria, the Victorian government, hasn't shut down the coal-fired power stations. The commercial operator of that particular coal-fired power station shut it down because it was no longer viable. Certainly, it's a difficult transition, but the reality is that we're not going to get new coal-fired power. We're going to have other means of generating electricity. AEMO itself put out a report last year on the most cost-effective ways of replacing the ageing coal-fired generators that are going to retire. And it ranked them as solar, wind, renewable energy storage, and some gas plants to meet peak demand plus new transmission lines. There was no mention of coal.
AEMO does say, though, that all the resources at our fingertips have to be brought to bear on this problem. That's their words, all the resources.
AEMO, it gets judged, the energy market operator, it gets judged on supply reliability. That's its brief. And naturally, it's very conservative about that and wants more supply. And it's frustrated by the lack of policy certainty that we've had, which has deterred new investment. But simultaneously with what it's saying, there are other things going on, such as demand response initiatives, where big companies are volunteering to cut their use during periods of peak demand, maybe shut down a production line and get paid for it. And there's lots of these demand response initiatives which use basic economics, price incentives, to reduce demand. And how we're going to get through this is actually a combination of some new supply and quite a bit of cuts to actual demand in peak periods through these kinds of initiatives.
Investigative reporter Stephen Long from the ABC's Business Unit. You're listening to PM on the radio, on the ABC Listen app and via podcast. I'm Linda Mottram, and on Twitter I'm at Linda Mottram. Are you into the fermented drinks fad? Well, listen up, because there's a warning about alcohol in drinks like kombucha and kefir, a warning that's surprising some health-conscious consumers.
Probably once or twice a week.
Do you ever think about whether there's any alcohol in them?
No, I don't, and actually don't assume that there's any alcohol in them. So
you think they're completely alcohol-free?
Yeah, I don't check, yeah. So I might have to start looking into it.
Scientists and conservationists are fearful of the global impact of massive fires that are raising parts of the Amazonian rainforest. The blazes can be seen from space. They plunged the Brazilian city of Sao Paulo into darkness earlier this week as smoke filled the air. Many are blaming Brazil's president, who in a few short months has presided over a big increase in forest clearing and who is hostile to conservationists, even suggesting some of them are behind the fires. Isabel Rowe reports.
The best way to gauge the scale of the fires in the Amazon forest is from the air.
Burning right now is about 9,500, according to the Brazilian government agency, about half of those are in the Amazon itself.
Go higher still and the smoke is visible from space. While on the ground, the Brazilian city of Sao Paulo was choked by smoke earlier this week, going dark just after dawn. Dr. Martin Taylor is with the World Wildlife Fund in Australia and is watching in dismay as the world's biggest forest endures an unprecedented burn.
So about 84% increase in fire incidents in just 1 year. That's a huge leap.
Fires often burn in the Amazon forest, particularly at this time of year. But Dr. Taylor explains this dry season is different.
It's part of the process of tree clearing to light fires. So the burning, yes, there's always a level of burning goes on, but this sudden leap up in burning is really just a symptom of the leap upwards in the amount of deforestation that's happening.
Conservationists blame Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, who has previously welcomed the clearing of the Amazon for development and cattle farming. But Jair Bolsonaro has hit back, initially dismissing the fires as a normal occurrence, and then appearing to point the finger at groups whose government funding he recently cut.
I'm under the impression that it could have been set by the NGOs because they had asked for money. What was their intention? To bring about problems for Brazil.
Dr. Deborah Farias is an expert in Brazil foreign policy at the University of New South Wales. She says such accusations are common for President Bolsonaro.
The president has said the most absurd things when it comes to the Amazon. He said that the only people who really care about the Amazon are vegans.
And she agrees that his desire to see the forest developed has encouraged the lighting of illegal fires.
What you have is essentially this sense that whomever was interested in doing all the clearing and all the cutting, that they're very likely to get away with it.
As well as being home to more than 2,000 species of animals and indigenous tribes, the Amazon produces 20% of the world's oxygen. Dr. Martin Taylor foresees similar levels of burning in years to come, unless President Bolsonaro has a change of heart in his environmental policy.
I mean, you know, this is what he called for. So is anyone surprised? I mean, they've lightened up on enforcement actions. So enforcement actions have dropped enormously, which is giving a green light to deforestation, whether it's legal or illegal.
Is there anything that the World Wildlife Fund in Brazil and other conservationists can do at this point?
Well, I think, you know, we just call on international sanctions to have this kind of wanton destruction of one of the world's great ecological treasures is unforgivable.
Dr. Martin Taylor from the World Wildlife Fund, Isabel Rowe, our reporter there. Indonesia is facing one of its worst outbreaks of unrest in years as riots and rallies in Papua erupted in more towns and protesters set fire to buildings across the region. More than 1,000 security personnel have been deployed and Indonesia's security minister flew there overnight to try to calm the situation. The riots were triggered by the arrest of Papuan students in Java at the weekend, but the rioters are now protesting about far more. Indonesia correspondent Anne Barker reports.
It was a flag-raising ceremony that triggered the latest outbreak of violence. Papuans at the village of Fakfak ran wild as they brandished the pro-independence Morning Star flag, a deliberately provocative and illegal act, singing "We're not red-white" with a Morning Star. Papuans can face years in jail just for flying the flag. Similar acts in the past have led to arrests and beatings as Indonesia has kept a heavy hand on separatist unrest. Indeed, a pro-Indonesian group turned out with the red and white flag singing the Indonesian national anthem. From there, things quickly deteriorated and Papuan activists say civil militias under the watch of Indonesian forces then torched an indigenous council building nearby. The wave of riots and arson has now engulfed towns and villages across two Papuan provinces with no clear end in sight, according to Amnesty International's Usman Hamid.
Without proper investigation toward the allegation of torture, the allegations of racism and discrimination, this will continue to be escalated.
Indonesian President Joko Widodo for years has promised to improve human rights in Papua, to investigate past abuses and allow foreign journalists into the troubled region. But Amnesty says nothing has changed, and just this week a foreign ministry official in Jakarta laughed when the ABC rang seeking permission to visit Papua.
Up until the first terms of Jokowi's leadership ended this month, there has never been any real progress when it comes to the questions of justice.
Indonesia instead points to new roads and infrastructure in Papua as proof it's committed to raising living standards. But Papuans like Albert Mungwa say many projects are built on land taken from families like his own. The development that's happening there is what they give us after taking our natural resources, he says, so it's their obligation to build there. And one of the biggest protests yesterday was at Timika, site of the world's biggest gold mine that effectively opened 1 year after the controversial referendum that placed Papua under Indonesian control. Many Papuans like Albert Mungwa say the only long-term solution is for a second referendum to give all Papuans a right to decide their future. This is Anne Barker in Jakarta reporting for PM.
Do you have a bottle of kombucha in your fridge? Or maybe you've attempted to make it yourself? Fermented drinks like kombucha, as well as kefir and ginger beer, are hugely popular among health-conscious consumers. But there's evidence to suggest the alcohol content in some commercially available brews might exceed food safety standards. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
At a busy inner-city supermarket in Perth, Laura has come in on her lunch break to grab a sandwich and a drink.
So I've just noticed that you've just picked up one of those kombucha drinks. Do you drink them often?
Yeah, probably once or twice a week.
And would you say you drink them more for your kind of health?
Yeah, health-related purposes. Yeah, just like gut health and whatnot. So, yeah.
Do you ever think about whether there's any alcohol in them?
No, I don't. And actually don't assume that there's any alcohol in them. So
you think they're completely alcohol-free?
Yeah, I don't check, yeah. So I might have to start looking into it.
The kombucha Laura has in her hand is likely to have some alcohol content, but it will be a tiny amount, less than 0.5%. A small amount of alcohol is produced in the fermentation process. But there's evidence to suggest that a significant number of these products don't comply with the Australia-New Zealand Food Standards Code. A recent Victorian Health Department report found more than 20% of products it sampled had an alcohol content equal or greater than 1.15%. That's the limit for non-alcoholic products. And the New South Wales Food Authority found 15% of products it tested containing alcohol had no warning at all. The alcohol content found in these products was as high as 5.3%, about as strong as a beer. Kombucha brewer Jeff Lowe says it's an issue the industry has had to grapple with.
We had trouble containing the amount of alcohol in the kombucha. Brewing it as you do on your windowsill at home, it doesn't work to do it commercially. You have to really monitor every step of the way to be able to control the alcohol.
Jeff Lowe says it's still a young industry, but things are improving.
The Food Authority is all over it, and they've been extremely generous with some brewers who were a little over in warning them and putting them back in their place and getting them to learn how to do it correctly.
The labelling and alcohol content limits are set by each state and territory under the guidance of Food Standards Australia New Zealand. Breaches need to be reported to regulators in each state. Public Health Association of Australia CEO Terry Slevin says the number of products that have breached their alcohol limit is a worry.
Well, it is a little concerning when there's a product on the shelf in supermarkets, petrol stations, corner stores that have an alcoholic content that could be approaching the level of a full-strength beer.
He says it's a matter of giving consumers all the facts.
Well, very clearly, there's a lot of people who shouldn't be drinking. By law, we're not allowed to sell alcohol to children, people under the age of 18. Clearly, we're getting more evidence about the effect of alcohol on unborn children. So fetal alcohol disorders and the like are of concern. And so we're recommending alcohol-free pregnancies for women. People who have been having problems with alcohol in the past, who are defining themselves as alcoholic and therefore choose not to drink, all of these people need to know if there's alcohol in a beverage, and if there is alcohol in a beverage and they don't know about it, then that's bad news and it should be avoided and prevented.
The levels we're talking about are still quite low. I mean, it might exceed 1.5%, but that might just be 2 or 2.5 or 3%. The testing was up to 5% in this particular government report. Even at that level, why is it important to know?
Well, if you think about those, when it gets to levels around 3.5%, 4%, 5%, we're talking about, you know, some mid and full strength beer kind of standard when it comes to alcohol content. And I think everybody would agree that it makes sense if people are going to drink a beverage that has that level of alcohol, they should at least be aware that that's the case.
The Federal Health Department has held talks with industry and state authorities and has emphasised the need for products to be appropriately regulated.
Bridget Fitzgerald with that report. I'm Linda Mottram. That is PM for today. You can always find us at the ABC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. That's where you should subscribe and leave us a review too. AM and The World Today are also there, so subscribe to them and leave them a review as well. Talk to you next time.
Hey, Fran Kelly here.
And I'm PK. We have a new episode of The Party Room out.
It's all about foreign policy, China's influence in the Pacific, and, of course, our relationship with Beijing.
Plus religious freedom, the government's proposed anti-discrimination laws, and a little bit about Jacinda Ardern.
Our guest is Chris Uhlman, and you can get it on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.